Welcome to the Compassionate Capitalist Radio Show with host Karen Rands. A compassionate capitalist is someone who invests their money into entrepreneur endeavors to bring innovation to the market and create wealth for all those involved. Karen shares insights and best practices for entrepreneurs to succeed and investors to share in that success without all the risks. And now.
Welcome to the Compassionate Capitalist Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. Watching, if you're watching on YouTube or listening on your platform of choice. I am very excited about my speaker. It's been a while since we've dealt with this topic, but it's a really critical topic. We're going to talk about buy-sell agreements. And if you haven't heard of them, now you have. And if you have been meaning to put one in place, now is the time. And this is important for both entrepreneurs and investors, because you know the type of investors that will read my book, Inside Secrets to Angel Investing, may be people that you know invest. They're a small shareholder and therefore don't have a lot of say in it. But you want to make sure if you've got two co-founders or more, multiple founders in a business, that they have a buy-sell agreement in place. If you are a silent partner in a business. And the primary financing, because maybe it's a community-based business, not some big scalable business, is even more important. You have to sort of think about buy-sell agreements like a living will or a power of attorney. You don't really, then you might personally have known you needed to get, and hopefully you have those in place, and you don't think you really need it until you need it, right? And then it's too late. And so my guest today, Paul Hood. Wave your hand for those that are watching, Paul, and say hello. Let me introduce him and understand why this is so important. And I apologize if I sound a little nasally. Down here in Atlanta, we got spring happening. If you've never been in Atlanta when it's springtime, pollen time, it can come on strong. So Paul is he hails out of New Orleans or out of Louisiana as his native state, but now resides in Ohio, and he got his law degree down there, or his master's of tax law, his undergrad down in Louisiana. I apologize, but his master's in tax law up at Georgetown, and he's an author, speaker, consultant on tax, estate, and charitable planning. He has authored 9 books and over 500 professional articles on estate, charitable, and tax planning and business valuation. His 9th book, Yours, Mine, and Ours, Estate Planning for People in Blended or Step Families, is now out. The one we're going to focus on today, this is one of his, if you're watching, we got buy-sell agreements, but we're also going to touch on, as we wrap up, how it impacts when you've got a blended family. And anytime people are in business for a very long time, there's a good chance that there will be a situation that the family dynamics change. And so you have to anticipate that and think about that. So he's a professor over at University of New Orleans, Northeastern, the University of Toledo College of Law, in Ohio Northern University, Petit College of Law. So there you go. Excellent. Expert in the topic that we are going to have today about buy sell agreements. So officially welcome, Paul. How you doing?
I'm great today. Thank you for inviting me. This is a very, very important topic. Yes. And too often one that that people don't realize how important it is until it's too late.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So what made you want to go into tax law? What made you decide to take your career into that trajectory?
Well, you know, it's funny. I actually expressed an interest in being a tax lawyer when I was 10 years old, when my father, who was a CPA, introduced me to a lawyer who also was a CPA. And my dad casually mentioned that it was great that he was able to combine law and tax. And I thought as a 10-year-old, that was pretty cool. The area of buy-sell agreements, though, and the principal motivator behind my eventual expertise and a niche area of my practice was family-based. When I was 8 years old, in our hometown of Alexandria, Louisiana, my grandfather and an older partner had founded a company back in 1923. And they sold seeds to farmers and then eventually expanded the business into other areas. And by 1968, when I was 8 years old, they had like 130 employees. And it was a big business. Well, during the summers when we were out of school, we ate our big meals down south at noon, or actually at our house at 12:15, not 12:10 or 12:20, 12:15. But one day a week, my grandparents, Momo and Papa, would come to our house for lunch. And one day a week, we would go to Momo and Papa's house, where we were joined by my mother's brother, who worked for my grandfather at the company, and my aunt and my four cousins. So we one day, and the kids sat at a different table from the adults, but one day during the summer, there was a spirited discussion going on at the adult table. And I, of course, had big ears, so I had to listen, you know. And all I remember hearing about was Uncle Bobby got fired and Papa was getting redeemed. And that always, you know, and the next morning on the local radio station, the show that we listened to every morning, and these guys were on the air for 40 years, they were talking about it on the air. You know, this kerfuffle at Alexandria's seed. So fast forward to me going to law school, and my grandfather died when I was a junior in law school, so I never had a chance to talk to him about Alexandria seed. And unfortunately, my uncle died prematurely of a heart attack, and I never had a chance to talk to him either.
Oh.
But when I was a brand new lawyer, I was at the Louisiana Secretary of State's office filing some documents and picking up some documents, and I had to wait for something. So while I was waiting, I asked them to pull the charter for Alexandria Seed. And usually the buy-sell language is not in the public document. It's usually if it's in a governance document, it's in the bylaws, which are private. If it's a corporation, or the operating agreement, or sometimes even a partnership agreement, if it's not public. But this was 1923, Central Louisiana, and the buy-sell language is in the articles. And so I looked at it, and what it was essentially was a perpetual call by the majority stockholder at book value at any time. And unfortunately, my grandfather was like a 49% partner, and his partner, who he had had deference to, was 51, even though they viewed themselves as equal partners. But they both brought kids into the business, and that's where the problem arose, because the kids had different views on the business. And finally, my grandfather's partner prevailed upon his dad to cut us out. So I started becoming I started reading and writing about buy-sell agreements, and I started drafting them, and I started getting hired to write them and to review them and to critique them. Eventually, malpractice insurers would hire me in cases involving defective buy-sell agreements. So and that's really kind of how it started. So the book is personal. Okay.
Yeah.
The book is personal.
Well, it's really well done and very easy to understand, very methodical in how it goes through explaining that a buy-sell agreement, trigger events, nuances of things to think about that, you know, I guess that's what they pay you for, but it's like, it's one of these things where, you know, I kind of know about buy sell agreements, but all kinds of little aspects that I wouldn't have just thought about had it not, you know, been suggested in your book, right? To consider some of these things. So let's get into it and explain to folks, because I mean, the name of it is pretty obvious, buy sell agreement, right? But it's more than just that, because it's not just buying and selling. There's a whole lot of other kinds of things that can be covered within a buy-sell agreement. So let's talk about initially just sort of by the parameters of a buy-sell agreement and you know, in what circumstances. I kind of equated, earlier I said, like a living will. It's your directives of what you want to have happen in the event of certain things. But it's also kind of like some people might relate it to a prenup or something, because different founders or different partners, like you know, they have different shares. They bring different things into the business. And as you said, it's different, not usually in the article. So does a buy-sell agreement sort of fill in the gaps of what might be in the articles of incorporation or in a shareholder agreement, because there's other factors besides just the straight ownership in the company that needs to be addressed, and it can be addressed in a buy sell agreement?
As a matter of fact, yes. The book is called Buy Sell Agreements because that's how most people refer to them. If you go to my website though, and down, and I have an agreement that can be downloaded, sort of a model type buy-sell agreement. I always called my agreements interest transfer agreements, because obviously transfer, you know, connotes passage by will, by gift, intra-family sale. But actually, an agreement like a buy-sell agreement might cover some governance things, particularly on the financial side. Let's say your entity is a pass-through tax entity, like an LLC or an S corporation, or a partnership. That is where basically you get your items of income, gain, loss, deduction, and credit, but the decision on whether you get cash to pay the tax on those items is made by somebody else, okay? So many times in those types of entities, your agreement is going to provide, particularly to protect the minority stockholders or minority owners here, some minimal amount of cash, at least to pay their income tax, or what they end up with is what I call phantom income, which is, you right, know, the worst kind of income you can have. So yeah, the agreement, the name really isn't fully descriptive of what those agreements typically often cover.
Yeah. Well, and it's like there also to consider, you know, in the case of a lot of investor-backed companies, you do have multiple founders. You know, you'll have a tech person as well as like a marketing operations person, or you might have two tech people, you know, and then they bring in somebody that they like, in some cases, like I call them execs with checks. So you get right, somebody that's looking to kind of buy into a business. So they may put enough money in that gets them 30% of the company or something like that. And then they go out and raise capital. So they all kind of get diluted. So it's not a clear, you know, this one or that one. And, you know, you have investors, particularly savvy angel investors or angel investor groups, and even VCs in a C corp, they're going to take first position preferred stock. Right. And the whole goal is that they want to be paid out first.
Of course.
So it can get really complicated, you know, and you have situations where, you know, and I've seen these things where it becomes really big, famous lawsuits because, or you've got somebody that has a chunk of shares and then they just decide they don't want to do it anymore and they quit, but they still have those shares.
Exactly.
You know, right. And they just sort of walk away. And, you know, if you don't have these kind of agreements in place, you kind of get hogtied in a way because they have a vote, even though they're not, they don't care about the company anymore. And, but they could, you know, like if you want to go to sell it, they could, if they're still stuck there with their shares, they may, you know, have a say in such that it influences the outcome of what happens when you're trying to create some kind of liquidity event. So talk about, let's start with talking about the trigger events, right? In a simple thing where it's just two co-founders, and then we'll evolve into when you have the situation I described with multiple shareholders that have a large percentage of the company. So we've got, you know, somebody gets sick, somebody dies, there's a divorce in the family or something, you know, there's just a, you know, lots of different things where, you know, we've seen it where all of a sudden the spouse is a shareholder and involved in the company. They don't really know anything about the company. So talk about some of those types of situations and your experiences in anticipating and helping founders and owners anticipate these things that they don't really want to think about. They don't want to think that's going to happen to them, but, you know, how to anticipate that and plan for that when it comes to creating a buy, sell, or liquidity agreement.
Sure. Actually, on my website,
Wait, sorry to interrupt you. PaulHoodServices.com, PaulHood Services.com. Go for it.
There is a tool that I developed over 25 years ago, and it was a practice tool for me. I am a huge believer in one-page things. I believe that it takes skill to express yourself on one page. And when I was a trustee of a 9-figure trust for 11 years and hired on average between 50 and 70 lawyers a year, because this trust wasn't comprised of marketable securities, it was really interest in closely held businesses. So we had real estate lawyers, corporate lawyers, tax lawyers, securities lawyers. And I would make my lawyers express themselves on one page. And of course, some of them accused me of, you know, basically perfecting my client skills in that role. But on my website, there's something that I had developed called the buy-sell options grid. And it's basically two axes. It's a pretty simple thing. It's one page. And on the vertical axis are the triggering events. And I have probably 20, maybe as many. I haven't counted them lately. It's been years since I've counted them. Different types of triggering events. Most buy-sell agreements don't have more than maybe 4 or 5 triggering events. But I've got a whole list there. The horizontal axis is what I call the responses to triggering events. And that is in the form of a continuum, which might begin with no notice, no action, all the way to the other end, a mandatory buy and sell. And so what I would do with clients is sit down and give them each one of these grids and say, I want you to check the box. If there's a death, what do you want to happen? And they'd go down the continuum and say, well, death, you know, we're not related, so let's do a mandatory buy and sell. What about disability? What about divorce? I mean, obviously most people say, well, if I get divorced and my spouse has an interest, I want the right in the buy-sell agreement to buy his or her interest, okay, or control his or her interest. Sometimes termination of employment.
Right.
And we often distinguish between cause and no cause. And I tend to divide, you know, having grown up in a small town in the South, I'm a slave to common sense. And I divide triggering events into two categories, what I call good boy events and bad boy events. Now, the good boy events are things like death, disability, termination of employment without cause. Some people have a retirement trigger where they meet a certain minimum requirement to be able to retire, and they have the right. And usually in the good boy events, the good boy or his or her representatives, if he's deceased now, control their destiny. Now, sometimes it's a mandatory buy and sell, and you know they just get bought out. But in others, they may have a right to cause, and they may have a put right, okay? They may have the right to say, you have to buy my interest. So that is contradistinguished with the bad boy events, termination of employment for cause, competing with the company, loss of professional license to be an owner in a professional corporation, architecture, medical, legal, accounting. And in those instances, the other side has the control. Because, I mean, think about it. And if you're competing with the company, and it triggers the buy-sell agreement, you don't want it to be a mandatory buy because the company will be, in essence, funding its competitor, which doesn't make any sense. They may have the right to buy their interest. It's a call right, though, and it's not mandatory. So these things, but clients loved it because they were able to check the box and they understood. And when we came back 3 to 5 years later to review the agreement, they ain't looked at the 40 pages in the buy-sell agreement, but they damn sure knew that option grid.
Yeah.
And they all you had to do was put that back in front of them, and their recall was instant. And it's one of the most effective practice tools. And like I said, I developed it for me. I mean, it was to help my clients.
Yeah.
It's, you know, hundreds of people around the country use it because they found it as effective and easy as I did when I developed it. And it's on my website. So I certainly encourage you to look at it.
Absolutely. Sounds like a terrific tool. So how does, listen, two things. First of all, how do they determine value when it comes to that at that point in time? What's the best way to determine? Do they preset what that value is going to be, or is it based off of an appraisal, or how do they go about determining the value?
Well, value is a very, very difficult thing. You know, Publilius Syrus in the first century AD said, a thing is worth what the purchaser will pay for it.
Yeah.
Which is in essence the expression of the market approach and valuation. You know, there are three approaches. You've got the income approach, the market approach, and the asset approach. In a family business, there is another issue in valuation, and that's the tax issue, particularly if the estate tax or if you're in a state that has a death tax, whether it's in a state estate tax or a state inheritance tax, the value becomes relevant, okay? And in family buy-sell agreements, you want to always use fair market value as your standard of value. That's the tax standard of value. Some people use fair value, And the difference between, now fair value can vary from state to state in what the definition is, but as a general rule, fair market value recognizes the various levels of value, which start at the top, synergistic control, goes to financial control, marketable control,